Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet Professor John Dron in this episode. John teaches in the School of Computing and Information Systems at Athabasca University in Canada. His work addresses many aspects of adult education and technology-enhanced learning. John and I talked via Skype. It gives me great pleasure to be talking with John Dron, Professor in the School of Computing and Information Systems with Athabasca University. John's particular research interests are technology-enhanced learning, social learning, and learning design models, amongst many others. John, it's good to be talking with you.
It's nice to be talking with you too, Mark.
John, can you start off by giving us a brief overview of your careers and publications?
Yeah, well, I'm a late developer. After getting a degree in philosophy, which I discovered was actually no use to man nor beast when you wanted to get a job, I spent 10 years as a singer. And I got bored with that. And whilst I was being a singer, I was learning to do stuff with computers. So I did a master's in information systems. And I wound up eventually working for the university that I had got my master's at, University of Brighton in the UK, where I used to run the labs and the technical support and general techie stuff. I was the academic support manager. And I noticed that people... The lecturers seemed to have much nicer lives than I had. So I'd just started doing a PhD and a job came up, so I became a lecturer. This was really when I started the e-learning stuff, so this is around about 1997. And my master's thesis was about computer-aided learning, as it was in those days. We didn't have e-learning at that point. And I'd had an interest in it for quite a long time. I come from a family of teachers. I think I hear the sound of one of my cats in the background. he would just like to say that his career in e-learning hasn't been stellar yet, but give him time, he's only three. So I started my PhD and was sort of fascinated by the fact that there was so much. Even then, I'd run one of the first few hundred web servers in the world, and even then there was so much stuff on the web. I never experienced teaching without the web. I've always been at the very least blended. But the tricky stuff then was actually finding it, finding stuff that was useful to you. So, and I realized that as I started to teach that the students knew a lot more than I knew. So I was trying to find ways in which students could teach each other, could teach themselves.
Yeah.
And that's largely dictated what I've done pretty much since. It has largely been an attempt to get rid of teachers. that's what I wanted to call my PhD, but I think my supervisors wisely advised me that this would probably be a hostage to fortune and not the best idea. So it wound up being self-organization in network-based learning environments, I think that's the title. No, but from that, the sort of themes that developed out of this led me to develop some fairly distinctive ways of teaching. And I published my first book in 2007, which had a terrible title, Control and Constraint in E-Learning, Choosing When to Choose. The choosing when to choose was mine. The other stuff came from the publishers. And that was about... essentially ways of building social software. It was about ways in which you can create structures that can lead to better learning and how dialogue is a really good way of learning and the balance between structure and dialogue. I was much influenced by Michael Moore's theory of transactional distance.
Yeah.
And I started to develop big interests as a result of my interest in the nature of control. I started to develop big interests in motivation, and the nature of the educational machine. This is largely where my work has been leading for the last few years. Has been to try first of all, really, to understand why learning online is fundamentally different from learning face-to-face, in-person learning. and to think about different ways of supporting the learning process. So what can I say? Yeah, I mean, I did reasonably well at Brighton. I became their first national teaching fellow. And on the back of that, I came across to Canada to Athabasca, because Athabasca is, in my humble opinion, the most interesting university in the world. Every meeting was like attending a conference and hanging out with all the keynotes. There was amazing stuff happening in research terms, but also remarkably primitive stuff happening in teaching terms. So it's been a fascinating challenge being at Athabasca for the last 12 years nearly. And I've just finished being the chair of the School of Computing. And so I now have a chance to get back to the research and teaching that I love doing.
From Brighton to Athabasca.
I think I missed some important things along the way there. I was quite surprised the other day. I was just thinking about what I did in the early years. I think I was probably the first person to build systems that use tag clouds specifically for education. I think I was probably the among the first to do what Peter Brzezlowski called open corpus adaptation, an adaptive system that was not constrained to a set of pre-written resources. Mm-hmm. I think it was some of the earliest uses of social software of various different kinds in education. My students were doing blogs and things in the late 90s, and I was building systems that supported social bookmarking, which was pretty novel back then.
Mm, it certainly makes you a pioneer, yeah.
And I've had a lot of fun. I had a small input to the University of Brighton had what was at the time the biggest social software installation in an educational institution. I think they had about 40,000 users, which went up to about 100,000 in the end, before it finally died. And in Athabasca, Terry Anderson and I built the Landing, which is Athabasca Landing, which is a smorgasbord of social software stuff built using Elg. With which I know you're familiar, because your work with Mahara is definitely in the legendary category.
Thanks, John. It was many years ago, I think, but Mahara's definitely outgrowing me, but some fond memories there too. So, John, you've got a very wide-ranging collection of work under your belt. The ideas and themes that your work has provided, what are some of those that you still think are very pertinent today?
Well, it's quite hard to say, because my ideas have developed, but I was quite shocked browsing through my PhD the other day to find that I was saying very much the same things 20 years ago as I'm saying now. I think the stuff about the nature of online learning, especially in the social context, so that we shape our dwellings and afterwards our dwellings shape our lives, as Churchill put it. And there's been a slide that has those words or words very like it in pretty much every presentation I've given for 20 years. What has interested me all along has been the ways of leveraging diversity, ways of leveraging the creativity and genius of people who are learning, rather than those that we label as teachers, and the distributed nature of the teaching process. And I will distinguish teaching from learning there, I think, because we're surrounded by teachers. I mean, our whole environment teaches us. I mean, there's been this general theme of trying to, and I have to find a way of saying this that doesn't sound as though I'm the one that is in control. I was going to say giving control to learners, but it's not a question of giving control, it's a question of acknowledging the control of learners, I guess. And I think this is probably the big fundamental difference in online learning, is that teachers never have the kind of control that they've had for the last 1,000 years or so. And yet we act as though we do. And we keep trying to do things to maintain that control, you know, with the rewards and punishments especially. And that leads to issues of motivation, because once you throw in extrinsic motivation into the mix, then you're basically killing love of learning. And it's been the central challenge of education for probably thousands of years, but certainly in higher education for the last 1,000 years. this problem that what we do is inherently demotivating has dictated everything that we've done since. So good pedagogy is essentially to do with reintroducing the motivation we take away by the process that we designed for teaching. Where I think my contributions might last, or at least contribute to something that lasts, is this realization that it doesn't have to be that way. And having acknowledged that it doesn't have to be that way, finding new ways of putting learning together and supporting the learning process.
That's really fascinating. Did you have an example, John, of where your work has been applied that you could perhaps share with us?
Well, the easiest examples are probably going to be in my own teaching. Yeah. Because that's just how it works. It's hard to pick out any one example. I could describe general principles that I go by. I don't grade stuff until I have to, because you're kind of forced into this position when you're a professional professor. And when I do grade it, what I grade is outcomes. I give a grade to each outcome. And over the years, I've been steadily trying to let go more and more. So in my latest revisions of things, students themselves pick their own outcomes. They develop their own ways of working their way through materials. They decide what it is that's valuable to them, and they do it all in the presence of other students. I think one of the reasons that Athabasca hired me was because Athabasca is quite unusual in the way in which it does its undergraduate teaching, at any rate.
Yeah.
Which, insofar as it's self-paced learning. So right. Students can start at any time. Traditionally, they just got a study pack through the post. This is going back to the 70s. And they were allocated a tutor that they could call up on the phone once a week. And they had 6 months to finish, and that was pretty much it. That has been the teaching model at Athabasca, and still to a large extent is, although of course it's been updated for the somewhat more modern processes and technologies. The challenge of that, of course, is that you lose the social stuff. I've learned that collaboration is very, very difficult when you've got a whole bunch of people doing some completely different things at different times. But cooperation is possible. So a lot of what I do is to create structures where students can teach one another. They share their experience with other people. They create models of behavior. They have a sense of the presence of others, even though those others might not actually be co-present.
I'm really quite fascinated by the Athabasca model, and for those who aren't familiar with it might be good to just explore it somewhat. So it's basically heutagogy in action, isn't it? But it's also highly flexible for the student.
Yeah, well, it's heutagogy in the sense of being the personal learning journey stuff. The social stuff hasn't been particularly wonderful until relatively recently, and a few of us now. Some of the things I've done, the ideas have spread around a little bit, I hope. Well, I know because I've seen them. And that's one of the wonderful things about using social media, where students are sharing stuff with one another. You get to see the process. You get to see what other people are doing. It gives a huge amount of freedom to the learners to have more or less complete control over the pace of their learning. You know, they've got that 6 months and they can use it in any way that they like. And some of them, of course, use it in the last week of that 6 months. And this is the problem, that what we're overlaying this really quite radically different way of learning. I don't know, it's not really different, because it's what people do. They go along to libraries, they read books, they do stuff. It's not like stuff that happens in most other higher education institutions. And yet we do try to apply the same kinds of, well, particularly motivating things. So it is quite normal, and again, this is something that I've tried to change, for the main interaction on a course to be marks given by the tutor. Essentially, that's it. So the students submit lots of assignments. They get marks back. If they're lucky, they'll get some commentary. And that constitutes the dialogue, which is but it also means that that's considered to be what's driving the students. So the theory is that, you know, if you give them a reward, they're more likely to do it. And that's fundamentally wrong, unfortunately. I mean, yes, you can cajole people or you can threaten people into doing stuff. I mean, they're doing what you want, but it's not going to lead to lifelong learners that will love the subject. As soon as the reward or the punishment is taken away, they will have less interest than they would have had before, and typically they will lose it altogether.
So students respond very well to that model in your experience?
Those that actually submit their first assignment in this model, our retention rates are pretty good. I'm well over 78%, which compares favorably with in-person institutions. Mm. What that doesn't show is the ones that effectively never show up for class. And we're in line with traditional institutions in that we don't count those that didn't start. Unfortunately, yeah. That's often in the order, I mean, depending on the program and the course, that's in the order of 40%. Those who get through the Athabasca system and that thrive on it do extremely well. They have an extremely rewarding experience, but they're a tiny, tiny tip of the iceberg of those we could be getting.
Mm. I'm sure, too, that those graduates are very, very passionate learners.
Yes. It's wonderful to work with our students, you know, and especially once they get through to once they're graduates, postgraduates, you know, they're an astonishing group of learners. You know, one of the things that I love about Athabasca is that it is a truly open university. It doesn't care whether you've got qualifications or whether you've jumped over the hurdles to get to it. But it means that many of our students have left education early. They were disillusioned by it. They didn't, for whatever reasons, they didn't get on with the educational system. Yes, they are exceptional students.
Mm. Well, John, it's now coming up to, it's still early, actually, early 2019. What are some of your observations about online learning and education at the present time?
I'd say the big thing is diversification. There are some fascinating changes that are happening that relate to the sort of stuff that I think is interesting, particularly the things that are situated within a physical environment, things like the maker movement, the massive growth in homeschooling. The free university movement. These are the local places where people get together, but they're all supported by online stuff. It wouldn't be possible without the online stuff. So I think we are seeing an increasing move to what I have always imagined we should be moving towards, which is a situation where learners are controlling the ways they learn, the ways they get accredited, far more than before. One of the challenges of doing formal education has always been that their students are there to get the degree, you know, not necessarily there to learn, because the degree is currency in the job market. And it's pleasing to see that the job market is starting to disagree, that we're seeing some very, very large organizations not looking at qualifications anymore. I guess I have to mention MOOCs, because, you know, MOOCs are a big thing. There's tens of millions of people taking these things every year now, and many, many thousands of the things out there. And are they massively disrupting education? No, but they're part of a massive disruption. And I think that massive disruption is that increasing diversification and an increasing distribution of the teaching role. So I think it's an exciting time to be in this field. It's not the revolution that I imagined when I was younger.
Yeah.
But it's evolution in the best sense of the word. It's that unfolding into the adjacent possible. I think that's what's happening. We're seeing more and more little ecological niches that are being filled in lots and lots of different ways. And the potential for learning is absolutely huge. I have a tendency to quote quite often John Chalmers, who was the CEO of Cisco and in the late 90s, made a claim that e-learning was going to make email look like a rounding error. And it's absolutely true. It totally has. It's not happening in our higher education institutions. Oh, a little bit slow evolution. It's happening every single day when every Google search that we do, every time we look up something on Wikipedia, we're doing online learning. It's revolutionized the learning process. It's just we haven't really quite caught up with that yet in terms of ways in which we can support more than finding out who starred in this particular movie. That's where there are still some interesting challenges and still some mountains to climb.
I think your comment, the unfolding of the adjacent possible, is a really wonderful one. It's a really neat description, actually, of what is taking place at the moment.
Well, it always does, but it grows exponentially. I mean, that's just the nature of the thing. It's, natural evolution, like technological evolution. It's each time you invent something new or each time something new occurs in the world, then it opens up new possibilities, but it doesn't replace the old stuff. So the old stuff still has the same possibilities, and you've got the combinatorial complexity of all of that. So, you know, then you've got combinations of the old and the new, and then the new that arises, and so it goes on.
Right. It's a chaotic wonder, isn't it?
It is. Well, a complex wonder. I think there's a little bit of chaos there, but actually there's some marvelous self-organization in all of it.
Mm-hmm. So imagine now the research that you'd most like to see. I'd imagine in a week or two's time it may be completely different. But just at this moment, if you had an unlimited pot of research funding, whereabouts would you apply it?
I like small pots of research money. I like little things that are incremental, that are often as much fun as big things that are not. I'm going to get geeky on this one. I would like to put large amounts of research money into alternatives to our centralized learning management systems and the associated bureaucratic and pedagogical processes that go along with it. I would love to, you know, with unlimited funding, I would love to remove all of the centralized learning management stuff from a university, say, and give the options for people to reinvent whatever it is that they want to do. I think that would be kind of fun. I think there is a lot of research needed into understanding, into getting a richer picture of how people actually learn when they've got all of these online tools. I mean, even in conventional teaching, you know, the assumption that students are learning in the way in which we're teaching has always been radically wrong. You know, what we imagine we're teaching and what students are learning and how they're learning, they're two very different things, especially in the online space. Still, this big theme that has been following me for the last 20 years is the letting go of giving control back that we've taken away from students throughout their careers. I think the point is to be able to support diversity, because control and choice are not the same things. This was the big theme of my first book, when I said choosing when to choose. It's sometimes we want to delegate control to other people, and it makes sense to delegate control to other people because they know what they're doing and they know the map of the area and all of that sort of stuff. The important thing is to be able to take it back again whenever we want to. I mean, those general themes that learning is more under the control of learners, that it's distributed, that there is a massive diversity of stuff available, that teachers aren't the only teachers. I mean, all of these sorts of things have been themes that really, I mean, we can go back quite a long way. We could probably even find references in Dewey to this general kind of idea, and certainly in Illich. Very strongly. The challenge is to provide the means to make it easy for learners to choose. We've grown up with the kind of course level chunking, course in the sense C-O-A-R-S-E and C-O-U-R-S-E, that you know, learners can make a choice whether or not to take a course or a program. And that's it. After that, their choices have gone. I mean, although I like the ways in which I teach, which is really just about letting go, that can cause big problems for a lot of learners, you know, who don't feel that they're able or competent to do so. The theory is that I'm there, or teachers there, or other students are there to provide that support, to fill in those gaps, to help make learning easier. So finding better ways of allowing learners not just choice, but control, you know, where they're informed, where they have the power to make the choices. Perhaps empowerment is a better word than control.
John, you've mentioned a few names already in this interview, but are there two people you'd recommend as legends of online learning, those whose work or perspective significantly influenced you, and perhaps someone else who you think has an important perspective to share?
Yeah, well, I don't know if you've talked with George Siemens yet.
Not yet, no.
I remember even before I met him in the early 2000s, and I was reading his work. It was sort of annoying in a way, because I thought I was doing original stuff and he was doing the same kinds of things, or talking about the same kinds of things at the same time. But he was saying them much, much better than me. He has breadth of insight. He makes connections that many people don't make, and he makes them eloquently. And yes, he has influenced me. I don't know whether I've influenced him. I think he's influenced by everyone. So in a way, yes. And I think, I mean, he has been increasingly recognized as one of the pioneers. He's got a whole bunch of awards and a couple of honorary doctorates, at least. And they're very, very well deserved. And yeah, he did bring the word connectivism, which annoyed me intensely when he did that, because I've been looking for a word for what I was trying to talk about in my PhD.
Yep.
I'd thought of all sorts of variants, you know, and all of them have been used, you know, connectionism. Yes, okay, we know that one already. Connectivism, it was obvious. You said two.
Yes, one with an important perspective to share.
I think I would. I think I'd probably choose another Canadian. There are many who are more sort of gigantic in the field, but Dave Cormier. I think I'd go with Dave and his quirky sideways approach to rhizomatic learning and one of the things I think that Dave does that I really like and really, you know, mostly a lot of his work is essentially through his blog. He's not published a huge amount, but one of the things I think that's most wonderful about him, and it's one of the things that you've got too, is his understanding of both the technology and the pedagogy. I mean, having the wrong pedagogy with the wrong digital technology is just like, you know, putting square wheels on a car. You know, it's all about how it works together, not about what the individual pieces are. I think Dave totally gets that.
You've noted too that he invented the word MOOC.
Indeed, yes. Dave did invent the word MOOC. That was on the first ever MOOC, whatever it was, Connectivism and Connective Knowledge, back in 2008, I think it was. So yes, I mean, you could see definitely a legend, because he invented the word that's on everybody's lips.
Brilliant. John, I do need to wrap this one up. It's been an absolutely fascinating conversation. I feel as though I could just keep on interviewing you, actually, and just keep the conversation alive. But sadly, time is against us. Thank you for being a leader and legend of online learning, and thank you so much for participating in the program.
Well, thank you, Mark. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and nice to catch up again after too many years.
You can learn more about John and his work from our website. His Twitter handle is John Dron. That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com, to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.